walls grow to remove President Trump after last week's storming of the Capitol. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we speak with North Florida Representative Al Lawson about the violent insurrection at the Capitol and the drive to impeach the president a second time. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic, 1.4 million cases recorded across Florida from the state's Department of Health, with an increase of 111,574 just over the last week. And the cumulative total of deaths in this state, 22,912. Those are the latest numbers. The other big story of the week is happening in Washington. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Sunday the House will attempt to pass a resolution today calling for Vice President Mike Pence and the president's cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove President Trump from office. This after last week's violent storming of the Capitol. If the resolution doesn't pass, and it likely won't, then the measure will be brought to the floor for a full vote on Tuesday. The latest now on the impeachment push as we welcome North Florida Representative Al Lawson, Democrat of Jacksonville and Tallahassee. He is on the line. Congressman, thanks for being with us.
It's good to be with you, Melissa.
And I want to begin by asking you, what is the very latest from your caucus and from Speaker Pelosi on moving forward with either the 25th Amendment resolution or impeachment?
Well, they're going to move first with the 25th Amendment, allowing the vice president to invoke, to have the president removed from office the last couple of days. Because he's a danger to America. And if that doesn't work, which I don't know whether the vice president would do it, but then there would be a resolution to that effect that would be taken up on Tuesday.
Tell us, if you could, about your experience Wednesday at the Capitol and that of your staff. Tell us what happened from your perspective and in your office.
Well, it was unbelievable. None of my staff was at the Capitol except one, but was asked to leave because, you know, they've been practicing social distancing in the Capitol area, and they said no more than two people should be in office at the same time. You know, probably in most cases it happened more than that. And even I had staff that lived close to the complex area, the Capitol, was asked to vacate their place because of the situation that really occurred. I was not in the chamber at the time, you know, on my way, but everything just unfolded so quickly, it was almost incomprehensible to realize, Melissa, that the safest place in the world was under attack. And so it was just incredible how everything unfolded that day. And how they were able to take over the Speaker's office, the Senate President Chamber, and unfortunately, a female was killed. But it was the most incredible thing that you will want to witness in history. Nothing never happened like this since maybe in 1812 when the British burned down the Capitol area.
Congressman, here's what your colleague, Representative John Rutherford, Republican of Jacksonville, had to say about his vote to object to the election certification of Biden and Harris. He went ahead with his objections even during the storming of the Capitol, and he explained his reasoning yesterday at a program on Channel 4, WJXT-TV, our partner. Listen, if you could, to this.
So this is nothing new. We were following the process. These objections, these states that I've given you the list of here and all of what they did that was outside of the law and the Constitution, where the executive branch and even the judicial branch exceeded their authority and changed election law.
Representative Lawson, what's your response to Rutherford's remarks?
That's very unfortunate. Because about 100 and some members on the Republican side, really, it's embarrassing what they did and the things that they are saying. There's been counts and recounts by Republicans who is in charge of those particular areas. The courts have thrown them out. These individuals, and it's sad for me to say for my colleagues, were just online with the president, even though it's embarrassing now because the president was really a detriment to the American government and an embarrassment for us all around the world. And for my colleagues to say that they had, there's nothing that has been substantiated. All of that is rhetoric, you know, and should not be, we should be more concerned about taking care of the American people with this vaccine, with the vaccine and the COVID situation that we have, instead of just outright lies. And those are lies, and they have been determined to be lies. And it's really unfortunate that we would have members of Congress, you know, not operate in the best interest of the American people and the people in our district, but in the best interest of a president who is the frame, who has set all of this stuff and caused this attack on Congress, even have gone against the vice president that has been his supporter for the last 4 years. And people out there saying, kill the vice president, you know, had to hustle the vice president away from the Capitol. So that's wrong. It is not true. And you really have to stand up for what is right and stop the lies that are going on.
Let's be clear. The election was certified in all 50 states. Dozens of court cases were thrown out. There is no evidence of widespread fraud. In the past, no candidate who ever lost the Electoral College failed to concede the election or fueled conspiracy theories that incited a mob to riot, attempting to threaten to kill the vice president, other members of Congress. These are unprecedented actions. You, Congressman Lawson, you came to the defense of your fellow Congressman Connor Lamb of Pennsylvania after he stood up on the House floor and said, stop the lies about the election. Tell us about that.
Well, it happened real quick, and you had members on the Republican side who acted as if at some point in time they were going to attack him, you know. And so, you know, I was there, and I was in very close proximity to the situation that happened. And so, you know, I really got up to go over and to make sure that he was protected, you know, because it had gotten out of hand, you know. And so there was not a confrontation, but, you know, just being available to say, you know, we're not going to let this happen. We're not going to let you all continue in the direction that you're going to attack this man, you know, without allowing him to say his piece and for people to say shut up and all this other stuff. And so it really got out of hand, and it ended up being the most embarrassing situation that you would think that many of us had ever been in.
Let's go to Russell in Mandarin. Hi, Russell. You're on the air with Representative Lawson.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call. I absolutely agree that something has to be done with this president. He is not capable of running this government. Impeachment is probably going to be the only real answer here. And we can't allow the concern about the division in this country to stop us from you know, doing the right thing. This country is going to stay divided. It's obvious that the way that law enforcement handles BLM protests and attacks on our Capitol in very, very different ways. That is divisive. And if you go ahead and allow white right-wing extremists, internal terrorists like the president to get away with criminal intent, that is going to divide us even more. But the important thing is these people need to be held responsible and they need to be prosecuted.
Russell, I appreciate those thoughts. I hate to cut you off. Right. We just have a limited amount of time with the congressman. Representative Lawson, what about the police response? Actually, you know, the lack of adequate response to protect Congress Wednesday and the calls from those who said that the protesters were treated differently than other protesters that we've seen in Washington and cities around America.
You're absolutely correct, and that's what happened, which is so shocking. because there's been, when you had the Black Lives Matter rally, you had National Guard, everybody else around, all over the place, over 200,000 people. But we had Congress people where they failed to protect us and our staffs. You know, they wasn't there. They was, the Capitol Police were really outnumbered. Even there's been two Capitol policemen that one died in this situation, one committed suicide Sunday morning. You know, it's just really tragic. And at the same time all this was going on, the president and his family, well, they're watching all of this unfold after he had the rally, told him to go down there. He was coming to meet him, but he ended up being a coward and did not come. And we repeatedly called the president and asked him to try to help call these people off, and he wouldn't respond. He wanted to respond, you know, when we asked for protection from the D.C. police, from Virginia, from Maryland, you know, trying to, and they was waiting to get the order to come, and he would not give them the order. A tragic situation. Many of us could have been killed. We had a lot of women for the first time being elected to Congress, and they was frightened and scared. One lady said, "Why I came here, and all of a sudden my life is in danger, you know, campaign, but I come to the Capitol, you know, where I should be protected, and my life is in danger. What is going on?" So as a result, it's overwhelmed, police officer running. In some cases, there was police officers letting the people in. They had an order not to confront anyone. And, you know, from the media standpoint,
should there be an investigation into the security response?
Oh, absolutely. Investigation, the police chief, Capitol Police has already resigned in the House and the Senate. It is the world, where you think this would be a third world country situation, it's in America. And it's an embarrassment of America through around the world.
And I'd like, if I could, I know you have to hang up in a moment. Busy day on the Hill for all of you up there. But let me get one more call in. It's Robert in Riverside. Go ahead, Robert.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. I was curious, Congressman, what your thoughts were on holding other members of the of Congress and senators who continued to vote to object during the insurrection, holding them responsible and extending that responsibility to them, not just holding the president responsible.
Okay, Robert, and thank you for that. Congressman Lawson, in particular, should Senators Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz be censured or removed from their posts, as many have called for?
Well, they have really hurt themselves, and I think their constituents are going to make sure of that, but they should not be in Congress, really, because they're the ones who perpetuated all of this nonsense over and over and over again, and people will believe it because people don't know all of this. You know, these constituents are very fine people, and, you know, they were supporting their candidate. You know, the Republican had 70 million people voted for him. You know, they figured that this was the right thing to do because parties compete against each other for the leadership in America. And so as a result, but if you have members keep telling their constituents who are not exposed to what we are exposed to, that this is wrong, there was cheating, there was this and there was that, that's what really happened. And so you had members that were doing that, you know, and I tell any of my colleagues, I'm not there to take up for them. I'm not there to say what is right and what is appropriate, because we are only there because you all sent us there to represent you. But these people are afraid of their job. I guess they can't find anything else to do. And so they will lie and cheat in order to maintain their jobs. And that's not what it's about. It's about taking care of your constituents, taking care of America. We took an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States against everything. And that is that what did not happen.
I want to thank you for your time on this momentous morning. North Florida Representative Al Lawson with us. Thank you for your thoughts this morning, Congressman.
Oh, thank you all. And may God bless all of you.
We've also reached out to Representatives John Rutherford and Michael Waltz of North Florida for their thoughts on what happened last week in the Capitol. Much more coming up later. We're going to tell you how the expanding healthcare program, Care Connect Plus, is helping more people here on the First Coast. That's later on. But up next.
I think they're all important terms. We've taken them and we just turned them into something that they weren't intended to do, which is a gobbledygook.
Former Daily Show correspondent Bob Wildfong now lives here on the First Coast, and he's also an author. We'll go inside his new book, The BS Dictionary, after this.
The Democrats' victory in Georgia has reshaped the political landscape. It gives the party what it always wanted, control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. How does Joe Biden seize this moment and avoid the sand traps? Plus, the latest on the move to impeach the outgoing president again. That's next time on 1A.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
For black farmers in this economy, racism manifests in a whole lot of ways. One of them, pricing.
They know they're getting less for their crops than their white neighbor down the street getting for his crop.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. From crop prices to land loss, systemic racism in agriculture, next time on Marketplace.
Tomorrow night at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, former Daily Show correspondent Bob Wildfong is bringing his sense of humor to those strange terms we all use at the office. It's all in the pages of his very well-selling new book, The BS Dictionary. I spoke recently with Wildfong, who, by the way, lives here in our area now. Take a listen. Hey, Bob. Thanks so much for being with us. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Thanks, Melissa.
Now, you're a familiar name, an accomplished actor, former Daily Show correspondent. I didn't know when I watched you on that show that you actually had been a news anchor and reporter before went into comedy.
We have some similar background, journalist by trade, right? I went to University of Kansas and majored in broadcast news journalism, and that's what I did for 10 years before I got the comedy itch. Mm-hmm. And then switched into comedy and acting full-time and was fortunate enough to land a Daily Show that took advantage of my professional background as a TV guy.
That must have been a blast.
Yeah. No, super fun. I enjoyed my time there. It was like going to the Harvard of comedy, at least in my estimation at that time. And I learned a lot. And, you know, I remember when I auditioned, Melissa, it was on teleprompter in their studio in New York. And it was the audition with Jon Stewart to book the job. And they were very, like, they wanted to make sure that I was comfortable reading on teleprompter. And, you know, I was...
You knew how to do that.
I had to fight the urge to laugh at that. I go, well, there's a few things I'm really good at, but that's one of them. I've done that for 10 years, so I think I can handle teleprompter. So
you did that gig, and what's fascinating is that you actually now live here in our area. You and your family have moved to St. John's County, because your wife does work with the PGA Tour. So it's cool to have you in our community, and I'm excited to hear about your new venture. your book. It's called The BS Dictionary, and it's really selling well on Amazon, which is hard to do. Word of mouth, I guess, must be so strong for this. How'd you come up with the idea for the BS Dictionary?
Well, it ties in with my wife. No joke, the kernel of this book started about 6 years ago. My wife's the chief marketing officer of this company, Korn Ferry, that works with the PGA Tour, as you mentioned. And she was working from home one day and had a conference call. And as her husband, I'm hearing her talk to her colleagues. And she starts throwing around terms that I've never heard before in my life. Hmm. And as I recall, they included Tiger Team and Straw Man. And I was like, well, they're both in the book. Tiger Team is like a specialty team of experts that are brought in to solve a problem. And Straw Man is a proposal. It's like, we're just going to spitball. That's another BS term. But it's the idea. That's the straw man. And those were brand new terms to me. And I'd never heard my wife say those before. And what fascinated me out of that conversation is her colleagues were saying stuff similar back to her. And so when she got off the phone, I said, can you tell me what Tiger Team and Straw Man means? She told me, and then I fast forward about a year later, and I just kept track of it because I'm a comedy guy. So it's like, oh, there's some good material, possibly some jokes I can write about that. And then about a year later, I'm doing a consulting gig in the corporate world teaching presentation skills, public speaking skills for people in T-Mobile in Seattle. And I'm talking to them about these phrases, and one of the guys in my class said, oh, I keep a list of BS that we say here, T-Mobile.
Uh-huh.
And from there, I was like, I think we have a book.
Yeah, every company's doing, and every company has their own weird jargon that sounds ridiculous to anyone not in that world. I mean, I think of straw man being like a political phrase, not something you'd say in business, but okay,
right.
So
a straw poll. Yeah.
So, okay, so you, in this book, you've come up with hundreds of common business terms that people in the corporate world are using all the time, like ROI. Return on investment or bandwidth, or when people say in a company meeting, oh, I don't think we have the bandwidth to take that on. I mean, there are so many terms you put in here that I've heard myself when I've been in meetings. And so, you know, it is ridiculous and funny when you kind of take it out of the context of the company, when you just look at it objectively. These phrases are kind of silly. So how do you find the funny in them in your book?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Melissa. First off, they're prevalent throughout business communication. Just to set the tone of the book, to make it clear, I think they're all important terms, that they're there for a reason. They're there for people to communicate efficiently and communicate complicated ideas efficiently. But then we've taken them and we just turned them into something that they weren't intended to do, which is a gobbledygook, which is another probably BS term. We've turned them into something that it goes beyond, hey, I just want to communicate an idea, to I just want to sound smart by using the term, right? So that's what we locked in on in putting the comedy in the book. We were like, what does it really mean when somebody says it is what it is, for example? And we started to write jokes about it from a workplace perspective of, you know, what does it mean when somebody says it's not scalable? For example. So what we do in the book is we wrote a bunch of jokes that are our BS definitions of what it really means when people say these things. In addition, what's also in the book is the real definition, so you can know exactly what bandwidth means and scalable and ROI. And then the final component that we added in this book that I really was most excited about doing was the origin stories, the history of who coined these phrases when they started to demonstrate themselves in business.
So your journalism skills came into play there, I guess. Tracking
totally.
It down. What are some of the weirdest origin stories?
Tycoon's got a fun story. It's a phrase out of Japan around the turn of the century in Abraham Lincoln's administration. I'll cut out some steps here for you to make it quick. An ambassador from the United States over in Japan wants to meet the highest-ranking official in Japan for U.S. relations, and the Japanese have the top country leader is not their top military leader. So they're in a quandary where they want to fulfill the U.S. request to meet the top leader of the country, but also to be the top military leader. So they invent a term called the tycoon that is supposed to fit those bills. And it's like the big guy, right? You're going to meet the tycoon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the guy coming back from Japan brings that to Lincoln and says, hey, I met with the tycoon. And some people in his cabinet thought it was such a fascinating word and such a fascinating origin story of why they made up this word for us that they started to refer to Abraham Lincoln as tycoon. And then over time, then it latched onto wealth. And with Abraham Lincoln being the first tycoon, quote unquote, in American history, then it became synonymous with wealth. And that's its usage today.
Wow.
Is it your tycoon?
Okay.
So that's an example of an origin story. We learned that was fascinating, interesting, and had people behind it.
Yeah. So why do you think this book has caught on? Because, as I said, it's hard to do a big book with all the competition out there. And, you know, it's hard to stand out. But you've definitely touched a nerve with this.
Yeah, I think it touches a nerve for a couple of reasons. One, because it's words that we all use. You don't have to be a hardcore business person to understand and recognize these terms. It is what it is what we all use from time to time. Don't have to be a business person to use that. So you recognize the terms, and understanding their history and laughing about it as you go along is a gift, I think. And also, I think it resonates with people because it's really well-researched. I've done a lot of stuff as a journalist and a comedian in my career. And this project, this book, is right up there as one of the top proudest achievements I've done. Because all of the journalism that went into it, all the comedy that went into it, reads on the pages. So I think for those reasons, it's a good read and it resonates with a lot of people. I think those are the two main reasons why it's done well.
And I recommend this as it's a great holiday gift. You can find it on Amazon or at thebsdictionary.com. And so, Bob, you know, you've come out here from the left coast to the right coast. You're here in Florida now after being in L.A. What's next for you? What are your plans for our post-pandemic world, whenever that ends?
Post-pandemic world. Let's see, Melissa. So many things I could do. Really, right now, to be honest with you, my main priority is to be the best dad and father and husband I can be. Because we have three kids. Part of the reason why we're here in this part of Florida is because the school district is very strong where we live, and we want to take advantage of that. So I've got a freshman at Nice High School, and I've got an eighth grader and a seventh grade child as well. So I'm trying to be a really good dad to them and a husband for my wife, who's making all the money with her work. And then the other thing artistically, what I would love to do is follow this book up with a second and third edition, because you mentioned that we have about almost 300 terms in this book that we define in the BS Dictionary, but we have a working list of almost 1,000 other terms that are common that we haven't even touched yet.
Mm.
So I would love to write another book, another edition of this.
I'm sure you'll find a lot of good material. It's a pleasure to speak with you, and kudos on all of the success. He's comedian, actor, and author Bob Wildfong, and the book is The BS Dictionary, Uncovering the Origins and True Meanings of Business Speak, co-authored with Tim Ito. Bob, thanks, and have a great holiday. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Thank you, too, Melissa. And just want to point out, kudos, also a BS term.
Yes, it is. You got me, Bob. You got me. All right.
No problem. No problem.
BritBox and PBS Passport are now offering the best of all your favorite British drama, comedy, and more when you sign up at jacksbundle.com. Start watching today.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. Democrats and even some Republicans are calling for President Trump's removal from office after the attack on the Capitol.
Also, the number of deaths from COVID-19 continue to rise to the highest level since the outbreak began. That's next time on Here and Now.
today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
He wrote and recorded some of music history's biggest hits. So why is Barry Gibb nervous about his new album?
You're one of the Bee Gees. How could you feel out of place anywhere?
Oh, of course you do. It's the same for everybody. If you walk into another realm of music, you have to work pretty hard to be accepted.
Also, the aftermath of the mob attack on the Capitol on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow, starting at 5 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville University is out this month with a new survey where people that live in this area are asked an interesting question. Here it is. What is the one place or thing in Metro Jacksonville that any visitor should see or do before they leave? They've compiled the results and they're pretty interesting. Ray Oldakowski, PhD, is professor of geography and the environment at JU, and he's got the survey results for us. Hi, Ray.
Good morning, Melissa.
It's so fascinating to hear this because with the ongoing discussion about Lot J at TIAA Bank Field, people are wondering if that could become the unique place or attraction that Jacksonville is known for. So many other cities have things like the Space Needle in Seattle, the Arch of St. Louis, et cetera, the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. We need that special place or thing. And so when you put this survey out to people, what were some of the responses that you got?
We got a wide variety of responses, and that's what's unique about Jacksonville is that we don't have that one specific place that people mention. We get a wide variety. The St. John's River was the most mentioned place for people to go or see if they were in Jacksonville. And the interesting thing about the St. John's River, it has been one of the most commonly mentioned places when we've done this survey in the past. But now people started to mention activities along the river, and that's a new angle to it. I know when the city developed its maritime management plan, Councilwoman Boyer tried to emphasize activating the river, and you actually can see a little bit of that evidence in the survey results. So people don't mention just the river. They mention walking the bridges, taking a water taxi, renting a jet ski, taking a paddleboard out on the river, that sort of thing.
So the river really is at the top of mind for people more so than the beaches. Is that right?
Right. They were pretty close. The river was a little bit over 10%. The beaches were a little bit under 10%. And the beaches also get mentioned within the context of a neighborhood. And the other neighborhoods that generally get mentioned in Jacksonville are Riverside and San Marco. So people will say, well, if I were to meet a visitor, I would say, hey, go out to the beach and have dinner, or go to Riverside or San Marco and have a dinner on the patio or drink at one of the bars, that sort of thing.
So given that we don't have an iconic spot on the ground that Jacksonville is known for, the way so many other cities do, how important do you think it is, Professor, that we create one? How important is that for placemaking, city identity, tourism, and all the rest?
Right. For place branding, for letting people know what your city is known for, it's really hard to say to a visitor, well, we're known for a lot of things. So if you have a Disney World, if you have a Gateway Arch, it's really makes it easy for people to associate that place with a particular location. And as we mentioned when I was on last time and we talked about other things that Jacksonville is known for, we're not really known for any types of specific food or music or a person. So a place within the city is pretty important.
What do you think about plans to create a Museum of Southern Rock in Jacksonville to celebrate the famous bands that have originated here? Everyone from Lynyrd Skynyrd to Ray Charles, they're working on this museum right now. Could that be the attraction that eventually puts this city on the map in a cultural way?
Certainly could. Cleveland is obviously known for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. People specifically will go to Cleveland to see that. And one of the things we noticed that popped up in this survey was that people did point to some of the museums that we already have here in town. So they said a trip to the Kummer or a trip to Mosh was well worth the time of a visitor.
We're speaking with Ray Oldakowski, PhD, professor at Jacksonville University. He's asking folks in a new survey, what is the one place or thing in Metro Jacksonville any visitor should see? Let us know your thoughts about this. What does Jacksonville need in terms of a defining attraction? What do you think it should be? It's 549-2937. Now, you've been doing these surveys for a while, Ray. What has drawn you to this work, to this kind of research?
Well, I'm a cultural geographer, so we're very much interested in a sense of place. And Jacksonville is a unique location. It's a place that has always, when we ask the residents whether they enjoy living here, whether they think we have a positive image or not, they always respond positively. But as far as the way we interact with visitors, it's pretty difficult for us to say what's unique about Jacksonville.
And have you shared the results of your survey with the powers that be, you know, city officials, the Downtown Investment Authority, the Jacksonville Chamber of Commerce, and so on?
Yeah, they're here for us to share with them. We do publicize them when the survey is over. I haven't gotten any calls on it, but we certainly would be more than happy to help them with that. And we have data on this for several years, so we can look back in time. As a matter of fact, one of the interesting things from the last survey that was mentioned by about 10% of the people was the landing, but that doesn't exist anymore. So
no more of that.
No more of that.
Well, now you're a researcher. You're taking the pulse of other people. What would you like to see created or already amplified that already exists to promote the First Coast, promote Jacksonville and its iconic attraction? What do you think would make the most sense, and where should we spend our money?
Yeah, our physical environment is obviously an advantage for the city. The fact that we have a beautiful river and that we're located on the beach gives us an advantage over places that would have one or the other. But I do think something that's a built attraction would be of importance. I recall the program you had at the beginning of the year when you had the discussion on Lot J, and several of your callers mentioned that it would be nice to have somewhere to go late at night or in the evening to be able to say that there were attractions for visitors as well as residents.
So you think Lot J might be the answer? There's been, of course, a lot of controversy over how much money the taxpayers are going to spend on Lot J, hundreds of millions of dollars, but it is likely to happen. It's going to go through.
Right, and the payoff would obviously be as it becomes an iconic place that people would go to. And again, you've got built locations like that in other cities. In Baltimore, lots of people will mention the Inner Harbor, which is a built attraction to try and bring people into the downtown area.
Do you think that, for whatever reason, the failure of Jacksonville to crystallize around something like this has to do with the fact that we do have competing areas of town? We're the largest city by landmass in North America. We have beautiful beaches, and they're 15 to 20 minutes away from the attractions that could be created along the St. John's River. People that have never been here before, they're often confused about that. They don't really understand that if they, say, reserve a hotel room in downtown Jacksonville, that they're not going to be on the ocean. I've had a lot of people comment to me about that over the years. The layout of this area is so far flung, and there's so many different nodes that a focal point is hard to create, it seems.
Exactly. And the fact that we are the largest city in land area really does play a role in that. And Florida's a very competitive area for tourists, obviously. So you can have regional competition. Again, looking at the results of the survey, one of the places that people suggested visitors go to was St. Augustine. They said, you know, historic St. Augustine is a must. You got to go down there. But obviously that's far distance from a downtown location or even a Jacksonville Beach location.
Okay, so you've been doing these surveys for quite some time, Dr. Oldakowski. And I'm curious to ask, what is next? What's the next question that you're planning to poll people about?
Well, on culture, we always like to try and do these questions continuously through time. So we'll probably reintroduce the questions about things that Jacksonville is known for. Again, trying to find, and I think you're mentioning the Southern Rock Hall of Fame might be something where people say, all right, we are actually known for a type of music. Maybe that is something that we need to promote, and that other people would come here to be able to experience a museum like that.
Yeah, and you know, I really do think that might be something that could really have an impact. Of course, the Jacksonville Historical Society is behind that effort. You and Alan Bliss over at the Historical Society, maybe you two should get your heads together. What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And I did want to mention there's quite a few interesting little things here. You find the variety of what people mention. Some people mention things like going to Kingsley Plantation, going to Mayport Village, going to the downtown library, seeing a movie at the Sunray Theater, going to Sweet Pete's, going to the Treaty Oak Park. So it's not as if people can't think of things that would be fun. It's just that there's not much of a consensus on it.
Hmm. Always fascinating, though, to hear your research, and we look forward to the next poll. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Melissa.
He's Ray Oldakowski, Ph.D., Professor of Geography and the Environment at Jacksonville University, continuing to survey people across this area about this place that we call home. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but coming up, social determinants have so much to do with our health, and economic inequality is driving that. The new program Care Connect Plus is expanding on the First Coast, working to reduce those health care inequities in this region. We'll find out how it's working in St. John's and Flagler and Putnam counties in just a few moments. That's after the break. You're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. Don't go away. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Next time on The World, the sheer number of deaths from COVID-19 is causing many people to go numb. Psychologists have a phrase for that.
The more who die, the less we care when we're relying on our feelings. And that is a perverse arithmetic that we have to recognize in order to overcome that.
Combating COVID apathy. It's on The World.
Tomorrow at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Inspired by America's wide-open terrain, Dvorak's New World Symphony is known as one of the most popular in the repertoire. Gonzalo Farias makes his Jacksonville Symphony Masterworks debut on January 22nd and 23rd, leading the orchestra's presentation of the work the New York Herald said is a noble composition of heroic proportions that produced a hymn and an anthem to what American music can be. Visit jacksymphony.org for tickets.
The 32nd annual Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities began this week and continues as a hybrid event all month in Eatonville. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will discuss Hurston's legacy. We'll talk about editors of the Florida Historical Quarterly and visit the Matheson Museum in Gainesville. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, humorist Fran Lebowitz. After developing a now famous case of writer's block, she turned talking into an art form. She's now in the new Netflix documentary series called Pretend It's a City. It's a series of interviews with her, conducted mostly by her friend Martin Scorsese, who also directed the series. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The Democrats' victory in Georgia has reshaped the political landscape. It gives the party what it always wanted, control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. How does Joe Biden seize this moment and avoid the sand traps? Plus, the latest on the move to impeach the outgoing president again. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. It's a new program aimed at getting at the root of healthcare disparities on the First Coast. John Eaton is Executive Director of Care Connect Plus.
Hey, John. Thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Tell us about Care Connect Plus in your area, St. Augustine, Flagler, Putnam Counties. The pandemic has devastated this country, and you're working through this program to close the gap on healthcare disparities and other problems in the community. How is Care Connect Plus working?
Yeah, and so Care Connect Plus, we're a social health organization led by Flagler Health Plus, and our aim is to connect area residents with a single point of access that addresses unmet social needs that are affecting health outcomes, and those are known as the social determinants of health. So for us, we're not only a hub for clients seeking services, a single point of access where they can obtain all services to meet their unmet needs, but we're also a provider, a network of providers, I should say, up to about 65 today that are working in alignment to close the gaps on those needs for our communities we're serving.
So we're talking about homelessness issues, mental health for teens and young adults. There's a whole range of initiatives you're working on. Give us some examples of how this is working and some of the effects you're seeing.
Sure. And so to your point, mental health has been a huge need within our community and several others across the country. So in 2018, we actually worked with our local school district and launched a program called Brave, called Being Resilient and Voicing Emotions, that's supported by the players. And so our mission is to break down mental health stigma and ensure that all students and families in the communities we serve have access to those mental health services. So prior to the work, within our community, roughly 35% of students identify with a behavioral health need were actually connected to services. And so we knew that there was an opportunity there to support those students, families, and the school district. And what we found is that those gaps in care usually ended up being social. And so we know there's a provider shortage in our community across the country. In St. John's County, about 880 residents for every one behavioral health provider. But over the last 2 years, we were able to close the gap with the BRAVE program to 91% of students connected to a behavioral health provider. And that was not an increase in provider capacity, but instead an alignment. We created a network of 9 local youth behavioral health providers and have served over 800 families through that program.
That's good to hear. Now, just before Christmas, Flagler Health and Care Connect Plus announced expansion plans. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so we're really excited about the work that we're doing in St. John's County, but we've always served other communities within our region. And so during COVID, we actually lost Care Connect Plus Flagler County. And so we've been serving those residents since about April and building the network in that community and really expanding our model. We believe the Care Connect Plus model is replicable. And so really fundamentally looking at a hub and for the community to access resources, a really switch and transition from transactional interactions with our clients to more of a relational. We meet with clients and we really try to address the root cause of their need, not just the current need. And then finally, building that network of providers that address the community's real accurate needs, not just the perceived needs. And so that's been expanded to Flagler County and now most recently Putnam as well.
Flagler and Putnam. And as you have pointed out, the social determinants of health affect most
people's health outcomes, whether or not they have access to housing, education, food, basic needs. And so while it's exciting to see that your initiative is expanding and doing a lot of good, it just speaks to how great the need is in this region. And I don't think people often realize how great the need is.
Well, you're completely accurate. I mean, when you look at social determinants, things like food security, housing, even social support and transportation, social determinants and income, really, there's no correlation. Just because you're perhaps have a bachelor's degree doesn't mean you don't have unmet social needs, just like somebody who maybe has a high school education. So COVID really shined a light on the fact that we're all susceptible and have opportunities to address those social determinants. And really, you know, that's one of the biggest opportunities is the stigma associated with reaching out for help.
And speaking to that, how can people access Care Connect Plus?
Yeah, so we have two access points. Right now, our office is closed for COVID precautionary measures, but we do have a phone number, which is 904-819-3070, which they can connect with a community health associate Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. We also have a website, www.careconnectplus.com. And so when a resident or a client reaches out, we do a brief assessment that will talk through the specific needs and really kind of start to unwind what the root cause is, as I mentioned. And so if you're reaching out for some medication assistance, but you don't have an address to send the medications to, we're going to really work with you on looking at stable housing and other things that go into that. And so those are the two access points that we work with clients as today.
Thanks so much for joining us. He's John Eaton, Executive Director of Care Connect Plus. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Chorus is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield runs digital. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and check out our podcast up later today wherever you listen. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville, and we'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Enjoy your Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.